Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Sports Weekend here on Planet FM. It's a grey old day here in the city of Sales. A bit of rain this morning, so I had to get the old Uber in. I wasn't walking in, I should, because I'm going to lose some weight before I go down to Christchurch. Anyway, big shout out to Father Ted's Original Irish Pub. They're based at 1 Wellesley Street West in the Auckland Central Business District. They have a selection of local craft and international draft beers on tap. They have a selection of bottled beers, fine wines, good spirits, great food, and music Wednesday night through Saturday night. So make Father Ted's your location to go to. It's not just a pub, it's an experience. Their number is 09377 3142, or you can email them fatherteds@hotmail.com. Wow. Down in Christchurch, it is looking like advantage England in the first cricket test of the summer here in New Zealand. Here to speak to us, as he does all the time, he's the most stylish cricket commentator in the world. Let's say good morning to Garth Galloway. Good morning, Garth.
Another big introduction from you, Eamon. Thank you and good morning.
Yep. Okay, so I'll pass on my bank account details for mentioning that. But obviously, dress up day, and Galloway will be, you know, Galloway, if you look on the Sports Nation app, you'll see Galloway looking very, very dapper. He'll be telling a few of them to maybe lift their games. McCarty, maybe Smith, really need to lift their games a bit, because it's going to be it is dress-up day in Christchurch. But advantage England in this one, Garth, because England won the toss. They batted. Williamson, really good, 93. Phillips, 58. Latham, 47. But then yesterday, England, 319 for 5. Harry Brock, 132 not out. Ollie Pope, 77. Ben Stokes is there on 37. But the partnership, fantastic from England. But really, this was opportunities for New Zealand. Nathan Smith, when he was bowling, looks like he was giving the English a bit of trouble.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that it is advantage England. This morning will be critical. You always talk about in a test match that, oh, the next hour is going to be absolutely vital. And so often it is that way. But this hour coming up from 11 o'clock onwards, with England resuming 29 runs behind and still with 5 wickets in hand, it's going to be, you know, really important. 6 overs remaining with the old ball, and then New Zealand gets an opportunity to have a crack with the new ball. And that'll be, you know, interesting. That also, of course, creates an opportunity for the English, who love to hit the new ball. You know, it comes off the bat faster, the fielder's in, looking for catches and so on. So, look, it's going to be really interesting. And just touching on what you were saying about Nathan Smith, yes, we were very impressed with him. He had catches dropped off his bowling. His figures should be a lot better than they are. But he was impressive. Hitting the speed of around 137 kilometres an hour frequently. And the other bowler I thought was outstanding was O'Rourke, whose figures do not do him justice. First time we've seen a New Zealand bowler consistently hitting speeds of 145 kilometres an hour for a long time. And he troubled the English batsman. He troubled Pope a little bit with the short ball, and he created opportunities with his speed. I felt at times, possibly, he was bowled for an over too long a couple of times, bowling 6 over spells. I'd like to see him. Just thought, for me this morning, one of the thoughts that I've had, I would love to see him be given the new ball. And just to bowl 3 overs of quick stuff. If they haven't lost a wicket by the time the new ball's taken, love to see him come on and have a go at Brook and Stokes.
Yeah, because when you look at it, like, you're talking about new ball bowling, and of course there's no better man who loves fast bowling at him and Ben Stokes. He can really hit that ball.
Oh, he can, and I was lucky enough to be at Lord's last year when Bierso was, the Kiwi underarm runner from behind the stumps when he walked out of his crease, and Stokes went absolutely nuts after that and scored 150, and it was one of the, it was an incredibly special innings. He was belligerent. He was angry about what had occurred, and he took it out on the Australians, and his ball striking that day was phenomenal. So, New Zealand will rue the fact that he was dropped in covers by Latham. And it was a catch. It was a straightforward catch, one that should have been taken. And everyone knows that, and most of all, Tom Latham. And you can't do anything about it now. You've got to forget about it. But as people looking at the game, you know, you wonder, obviously, just how expensive that's going to be. I thought Stokes played a really good role yesterday, 37 from 76 balls. He bowled, he really played around Brook a bit. You know, we didn't see him. He's such a good player, Stokes. You know, he could bat anywhere in the batting lineup. It looks like he has an excellent technique. And I just thought he did a very fine job supporting Brook, who was outstanding as usual. He had his luck. He won't have many days where he gets dropped three times in Test cricket, particularly with some of them being reasonably straightforward. But he rode that, and he's a class player.
I was just looking at this. New Zealand really, as you said, do need to take quick wickets. They don't want England to get a 200 or 250-run lead on them, do they?
That's the danger. That is exactly the danger. 29 runs behind. You would think if New Zealand can't take a wicket in those first six overs, England will have parity with New Zealand. You know, they'll be somewhere around that first inning score of New Zealand's of 348. And from there, with five wickets in hand, you know, New Zealand, they could be facing a deficit, 100, 150, 200. If it's over 150 or so, because we're still quite well advanced through the game, we're only into day three, then I think that will be problematic for New Zealand. So they must hold their catches today. They have to try and make inroads early. If they don't do that, they have to make them with the new ball. And if not, they're going to get behind the game.
And, of course, if we have to bat a second innings, there really is pressure on Devon Conway at the moment. The questions are now beginning to be asked. Also, you know, I noticed a lot in that New Zealand innings, Garth. There were a lot of starts but no finishes.
Yeah, there were. And I think, you know, when you look at how the players got out, you know, if they're being candid with themselves, they would say that they got themselves out, really, as opposed to being done by really good deliveries. Latham was the one who got a good one, I thought. You know, he played at a ball from Cass, which he just looked to play back down the leg side, a forward defensive shot, and the ball did just nip a little bit off the seam. He just played the wrong line and got an edge. So he was got out by a good delivery. But I think you would say Conway, Williamson, Mitchell, Blundell and co, all, I think, threw their wickets away, really. They'll have to be a lot more disciplined.
Yeah, and then of course, you know, we also look at some of, you know, the conditions in Christchurch. You know, what's it like down there this morning? Is there a bit of moisture in the air?
No moisture in the air, but certainly heavy cloud. I was up walking the hound up in the hills at 6:30, and there wasn't a cloud. It was absolutely beautiful. And now some cloud cover has come in. I think that might suit the New Zealand bowlers. The first session yesterday, the ball was cloudy, and when New Zealand bowled, Southee swung the ball around in those conditions. He really enjoyed them. So, you know, it's not quite the low cloud that we had yesterday. But it's certainly hanging around a little bit. I don't think we'll get rain. It's not forecast, but that might just help the New Zealand bowlers with a little bit of movement early on.
Absolutely. And, of course, looking over the other parts of the world, South Africa have a huge lead over Sri Lanka. And, of course, they bowled Sri Lanka for 42 the other day, and I couldn't believe it. But this South Africa's victory in this test really has huge implications. Possible implications on the World Test Championship?
Well, I think you have to look at it and think that South Africa are odds on to make the World Test Championship. I mean, they've done the final. They've got, after this match, a couple of games against the West Indies. And that really does, you know, at home, I think that puts them in the box seat, really. And then you're going to have Australia, India and New Zealand scrambling for the second place. I may be wrong. But I think if you were, you know, a betting person, a few bucks on South Africa to make the final wouldn't be the worst bet.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you there. I just feel if New Zealand lose this test match, you can throw away the World Test Championship final.
Sorry, just missed that. Just cut out there and distracted slightly by Shane Bond out on the field aiming. Could you just say that again?
Oh, okay. Say good day to Bondy for us. If New Zealand lose, this really probably puts their chances out if they lose this first test to England.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, no, look, I think it does. And look, there's a theory that if they won if they won two of these test matches against England, they could possibly get through. I think really to be sure they've got to get through and win all three. And so there's an awful lot to play for this morning. And so you just hope, just really hoping that that New Zealand will be able to pick up those wickets from a parochial point of view. And and you'd like to see them getting back into the match. They're not out of it. They're far from out of it. But they have to pick themselves up after the disastrous fielding of yesterday and start again. You know, flush that down the dunny, come out here fresh and look to take wickets early. Sounds easy. We'll see if they can do it.
And, of course, it's true. Of course, what attire is Mr. Galloway wearing today?
Oh, just a lovely, if you really want to know, a sort of green and orange check jacket. Lovely.
Oh, my goodness.
Subdued. It doesn't sound subdued when I put it that way, but pretty subdued, really, by my standards.
Now, I meant to ask you, have you been wearing the tablecloth shirt?
Yes, had one on yesterday, and I've got the bigger, brighter one still to come. That might be on tomorrow.
Oh, well, that could be critical. And, of course, weekend of commentating for you, and, of course, you'll be definitely up to on Monday morning to watch the Liverpool-Manchester City game.
Yes, and very much looking forward to that. I think, you know, if Liverpool can win that one, then they really are, you know, they'll go into Christmas and the break. There's still a few more games to come, of course, but if they can win that and keep picking up 3 points, then they go into that Christmas break. You'd have to be starting to think that, you know, that they could be in a pretty confident position. I always think that, you know, they can slip up against any side. It's a tough competition. I've always felt in the last few years that City have been the best side, as much as it hurts to say it. And you know, they haven't lost and had too many of those slip-up games throughout their seasons. They've been very good. I always think Liverpool, Arsenal and co. just slightly inclined to trip at the wrong time. But so far, so good.
Anyway, as a Manchester United supporter, Garth, my good friend Brenda McNeice, who used to do the football on the station when I first started, always had this quote, "I hope both those sides lose."
Good on you. Well, I mean, you really, Manchester United, I mean, you...
No. Here we go.
More to resort to except humour, have you? So keep smiling and try and keep optimistic.
Garth, I always appreciate your cricket views. I don't really like your football discussion at times, but anyway...
Understood, but keep languishing in the middle of the table. Keep happy, keep optimistic.
Oh, God, mate. I've got to find another... Since Noel Barkley's gone, I've got no allies. I've got no allies here. Anyway, you have a great call. And say good day to all the ones and all the boys doing the good work. Anyway,
will
see
do, mate. All the
cheers, bye.
Yep.
Garth Galloway, isn't he just outstanding? Obviously getting ready to call for Sports Nation, and I have to say, you know, even though they're another station, I actually really enjoy the cricket commentary. There's I find it really great to listen to. So, you know, after 11:45, have a listen to Sports Nation. Anyway, we must move on because what we are going to do is our final rugby review of the year. I have AJ Wetton and Stephen Harris. Now, we're going to discuss everything from the year in review to some of the issues around rugby today. So, anyway, I am just going to play a bit of music and then we'll hopefully have AJ and hopefully Mr. Harris on the other side.
And if you want these kind of dreams, it's Californication. It's the edge of the world in all of Western civilization. The sun may rise in the east, at least it's settled in a final location. It's understood that Hollywood sells Californication.
Welcome everyone back to the Sports Weekender here on Planet FM. Big shout out to Father Ted's Original Irish Pub for the best in a few drinks, beer, wine, spirits, good food, music Wednesday night through Saturday night. Go to Father Ted's, 1 Wellesley Street West. It is not just a pub, it's an experience. Their number is 09377 3142, or you can email them fatherteds@hotmail.com. Well, we have the, well, this is our final chat on rugby for the year. Well, maybe we might do a bit of sevens, but anyway, we're talking the 15-man game, and here to talk to us, former All Black great AJ Wenton. Good morning.
Good morning, Peggy. Not a good morning. The rain's here, but it's here, good for the garden. And, where has the season gone? Plenty of action and a wee bit of controversy.
Yeah? Oh, yeah, we've got a lot to get through. And also joining us is a man that helps out in rugby when AJ is unavailable. He is AJ's number two IC, and he's also been brilliant doing the regional rugby rap with me during this year. Please welcome his renowned commentator, Stephen Harris. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Amon. Good morning, AJ. And once again, always a privilege and a pleasure to be on your award-winning show, brother. I have to take into account the weather this morning in the 09. It's not the best, but I have a funny feeling it might burn off after lunch, hopefully.
Well, I hope it does. I was looking to go to the soccer today, but it looks like I won't be doing that today. I've got a few drunky poos this afternoon. But anyway, we might as well rip into it, guys. Okay, the Super Rugby, it ended up being a landmark year for the Blues. They brought back Stern Vern, Vern Cotter back in. He came with a lot of experience and a good record. Well, he proved that. The Blues really were the team of the competition. And we looked at some of the performances. Yes, they lost two games. They may have lost, what was it, one or two games all season, but they really looked the best team in that competition. We saw players like Hoskin Satutu firing for them. We saw Harry Plummer. We saw, basically, we saw the quality player we all knew he was. I thought it was a fantastic year. We also saw the Chiefs and the Hurricanes and the Chiefs, and, of course, the Chiefs, the emergence of a young guy called Wallace Satiti. And, of course, the Highlanders battled well, but then the Crusaders failed miserably under Rob Penny's first season. Some of your thoughts on Super Rugby, on the Super Rugby, starting off with you, AJ.
Well, yeah. Well, as I say, where did the season go? Yeah, congrats to the Blues. That's been a long time in the making. But we talk about the players, and you mentioned a couple of there. There's always a talking point about the Tutu, possibly, I don't know, maybe some off-field indiscretions or issues that kept undercover. But that's for another day with other people. But certainly, you mentioned Plummer. But also to Toi Polutu, I think it just shows Absolutely. You he's a journeyman. Just solid, brings in that confidence, and I think we just saw how valuable an asset he is, not only to the Blues but the All Blacks. And when he's not there, just something just misses in that pack with his leadership. But I'd rather talk about Vern Cotter getting a lot of praise. I've always admired him from a distance. He's a guy who's done his time. As we said, he's gone through the channels from club, NPC, dabbled a wee bit. It says a win overseas, not wanted here. Cut his teeth in international rugby. Had a lot of success over in France, and he had some disappointments. But he's been through the ringer a bit. And I just like the way he conducts himself. And he brought a lot of culture, confidence into the side. And I think that was expressed this year. We know there's always some talent, but it just wasn't displayed on the field week in, week out. During that lackluster 10-year, many, many years without a title. So, look, he's been re-signed. Look forward to what's happening next year and if he can repeat and start a bit of a legacy. So, overall, a competition that had quite a few highs in that area, but just the lack of quality week in, week out from my point of view. I don't know about you, Steve, but the Aussies, they're here and there on the odd weekends. Yeah, the odd sparkle from Fiji drew, but really a bit of a struggle to watch.
Okay, we lost you there, AJ. Stephen?
Yeah, no, listen, while you're trying to get AJ back, I have to agree with most things he said. There were times, if you watch this Blues team during 2024, sometimes the simplest game plans are the easiest way to play rugby, the modern game, and you could fairly say that the Blues were very, very direct. There were times that you could have probably stuck green jerseys with gold collars on them. That's how direct they were, and they just systematically broke down a lot of teams. We wondered by finishing in second place if that was the best position for the Blues to finish, but it actually worked out. It actually worked out reasonably well because they got the Brumbies in the semi-final, and the Brumbies have shown that whilst they had a very improved season, they still have an issue in and around travelling away. I do agree with AJ. Probably looking at 2025, I'm hoping that with the one less teams, that these Super Rugby teams from Australia will be a lot stronger. So when the New Zealand teams do play over in Australia, maybe they can throw a bit of a spanner in the works. But listen, I think from the time that the Blues, even before the playoffs, it was really their title to lose. So big ups to not just to Vern Cotter, but all their coaching staff, but also the players and the way that the senior players took ownership of this Blues team. And you know, that was highlighted in the fact that, you know, the likes of Harry Plummer put his name up there and got an opportunity with the All Blacks in 2024. But hey, kudos to them. And just looking at their squad, they're looking more than capable of doing it again in 2025.
Absolutely. Just looking at Super Rugby, and you know, we have one less Australian side, but looking into what's going to happen next year, it looks like it's going to be quite an interesting year. It's the top six. Makes a lot more sense. We have one less team. Somebody in this competition will think of a ridiculous idea to bring in an American team. We all know that. So, yeah.
I don't know. I think they've got the, don't forget, the contract goes till 2025.
Yeah.
So Sky's in negotiations. I think that's something that's on the radar we should be aware of. What actually are they bidding for and getting? So, yep, there'll be some very hefty discussions. What's the format in 2026? I have a feeling it could still change again. But what are Sky prepared to pay for the rights of rugby if they feel they're not getting a fair bang for their buck? So I think some very heavy negotiations with the New Zealand Rugby Union are forthcoming.
Stephen?
Yeah, I know we're going to talk a little bit about eligibility later, but I suspect there will be another team added to this competition, and it wouldn't surprise me if it's where the money is up in Japan. But I'm going to hold this back for the eligibility part of our discussion, because I think there's some changes that they could make to Super Rugby to make this even this competition even more exciting, and it might be a way of keeping some of our top players in the game, yes, as opposed to going overseas. But I'll park that one up for later.
Because I'm such a wonderful mind reader, Stephen, as AJ might know, I think I know where you're heading with this. Anyway, that was Super Rugby. Then we had a start of a new All Black era. We had some mid-year tests against England and Fiji. All Blacks, all in all, a couple of very close ones against England. Didn't really look convincing. But we all said, but it's going to get better. Well, we'll get more into this right now. But we went to the Rugby Championships. Two losses in South Africa. A loss to the Pumas. Really, this mid-season and rugby championship, I found the All Blacks to be pretty much, it was glass half full, as far as I was concerned. Gentlemen, starting off with you, AJ.
Yeah, look, I think that's a fair assumption. We're all anticipating what would Razor and his management team bring to the party after Fozzie's reign. Yeah, some excitement as well as probably some variation. It didn't really materialise. I think he had to get his feet under the table. Was a wee bit upset in the management plan when McDonald upped anchor and said, well, really, it's not for me for whatever reasons, and that'll probably manifest itself somewhere down the track. So there was a bit of a hiccup there, and I think it resonated in the performances. Especially Argentina, and fair cop to them. You know, let's give them credit. They came out, they had a game plan, they orchestrated it, dominated in some of those set pieces and just frustrated the All Blacks. So it wasn't coming to them easy. And I think that just the team and the squad at that time were trying to just gel, and they got caught out. Obviously, in Eden Park, they rectified that in spades, jumped on the plane to Africa. And we know how tough it is to go to Africa. And, two up and two down. Some good performances there, though. Some good rugby, but just, again, not consistent enough over that 85, 88-minute period. And possibly could have squeezed a win out of one of them. But that's international rugby. You don't get many opportunities, and they just weren't quite on the mark. And I think Razor's mentioned that they just didn't finish off when they had the opportunity, and that's the fine line in international rugby. So three losses, and then on to obviously beating the Australians, which we know have been struggling at times, put up a bit of a performance, but really not quite there. I think Joe Smith was just getting his feet organised also with his squad. So, look, yeah, challenging season, and then they headed up to the Northern Hemisphere. So finished off with that win against Italy with some big question marks. So, yeah, bit of a funny season, but a first season. So I think it can only get better, I hope so. But, look, 6.5, 7 possibly from my point of view.
Anyway, Stephen.
Yes, interesting. I was just thinking about that Argentinian game that was lost in Wellington, and it's quite an irony that the strength of this team was their scrum this year. And if we think back to that particular game, the scrum was taken right out of the game, wasn't it, fellas? I think the first scrum about the 60th minute or something like that, and I think it ended up having three or four scrums in the whole game. And it's fair to say that the Argentinians sort of took great advantage of that. But like you say, AJ, fair play to them. They played very, very well and stuck some real heat on us. And I just thought at times we looked like possums in the headlight. There were big games. I've heard some people go, oh, we could have won this game, but we also could have lost certain games. So the scrum this year, real plus for me. The downside is the continuation of the yellow cards that this team keeps getting. It's really annoying. It's fair to say it probably cost them one of those games in South Africa where they look to be finishing well. I think it's been a case of the coaches where it's been learning on the job with Razor. I suggest he probably looked like a possum in the headlights in those first few tests, but seemed to find his feet a little bit more. Also, the use of the bench, I think it took them a while to figure out how to use that bench, and I think once they found that they had their best, some of their best 23 on the bench. They were able to bring some impact off the bench. I love the way that the propping stocks are looking, and I'm actually, despite losing two really, really great All Blacks in Whitelock and Retallick, I think the locks are travelling quite nicely. I still don't think we've found our loose forward mix, even though, you know, obviously the rise of Wallace Satiti, but for me, just having a consistent first five, I personally think Razor should have stuck with D-Mac. I thought D-Mac was very good against Ireland, but we chopped and changed again and brought Bowden back. I think maybe Bowden's better suited to the bench. And, of course, there's that midfield. Two really, really big midfielders. Probably the biggest midfield pairing I've probably seen in the All Blacks history, but I just wonder if they're one of the same, if we're missing a creative type player. Even during your time, AJ, we've always had a creative or an organiser at second five, and maybe something that we're missing. And once again, we're still playing around with that back three as well. I can see why the selectors like Jordan on the wing. He's got that top-end pace. And speaking of top-end pace, I think that's an area where we got probably exposed in two or three games this year, that we don't seem to have that top-end pace out on the flanks. Of course, Caleb Clark, who brings you both pace and power. But I think both with Sevi Rees and Mark Dallaire, I don't think they're guys that, if you're going to give them an overlap 40 metres up, that they're gonna run it in. So that's a little bit of a concern. So I reckon the rating that you gave the All Blacks, AJ, is pretty much spot on, 6.5 to 7.
Absolutely.
That's probably about right.
Absolutely. And, of course, we shan't forget women's rugby. And, of course, you know, Blues are picky. Fantastic win. Blues winning the Super Rugby are picky. Waikato winning the Farah Palmer Cup. The Black Ferns Sevens, really fantastic, winning the Olympic gold medal. Sarah Hewany, what an absolute warrior. But the Black Ferns 15. And, you know, whilst retaining the Laurie O'Reilly Cup, and, you know, we haven't really heard the pressure on Alan Bunting, but they had losses to Canada. They had two losses to England, and they had a loss to Ireland. Starting off for you, Stephen.
Yeah, I think it's a side trying to reinvent themselves. You know, you've got to realise you've got the likes of Stacey Walker, who was a big part of that midfield. She's pretty much moved on. There's a couple of other players in the forwards, and there's a lot of newbies that are actually showing some promise as well. Remembering they had a very good halfback for many years in Kendrick Boxedge. She was a big part of this that team. She knew when to keep the forwards going. And all of a sudden, you find there's a new pairing there of Maya Joseph and of course, Rosie King as well. So they are a very, very new combination, and that was kind of exposed in that England game. But I can see some pluses in this Black Ferns team with some new players coming in. Their set piece is starting to look a lot better. So I'm going to look at more of a half glass fuller type scenario. Although there will be a couple of games that they'd be very disappointed with, namely that loss to Ireland. I think they'd be very, very disappointed with that game. I don't think the attitude was right at all. They put a lot of ball down, and I don't know if they paid due respect to the Irish, but there were some positive signs for this New Zealand side. And listen, I think they finished on a reasonably high note against a very, very good French team. And let's not remember, we were probably, if you think back to the last Women's Rugby World Cup, gee, we were wondering if we were ever going to make the semi-finals. So I think we are in a better position at this stage. But I'd be knocking on a couple of doors, the likes of Stacey Walker, and just seeing if she's maybe available for one last merry-go-round.
Anyway, AJ.
Yeah, I think you raised some pretty good points there, Steve. I think naturally Stacey Walker, I think you need that solidity, that IP or experience in midfield, and I think that's where we missed it. I think we had a few holes there through a few test matches. but summed up pretty well, Steve. You mentioned, obviously, Cockridge, you know, what a super player at halfback. So we're just replacing a bit of that talent. But as current world champions, you don't lose too many test matches of any. I mean, that's why you're a world champion. I know you're up there in the bright lights and everybody wants to knock you off, but you've got to stay on that mantle. So it's a work in progress. It's every match or training, you know. You've got to be on your game because you know that you're going to be challenged. And as you mentioned, we fell short in not one or two, but three or four matches. And whether it was just the lack of discipline or a bit of an experience, but, you know, you don't miss tackles like that. You don't drop the ball at that level on a consistent basis, especially against Ireland. You don't push that pass. And the tenacity of the Irish, I mean, I admired them. You know, they had a little opening and they took advantage of it. And you're dead right. They rocked the confidence of the All Blacks, and they're under pressure in a deserved win. The English, of course, are just a machine. Just right on point with their set pieces, and they wear you down. They just seem to have a formula that works at the moment, and that's really now the benchmark to try to get to that equality in the set pieces, because if you're not, you're pushing a bit of the old brown stuff uphill. So, yeah, a lot of work to do. I think that there are some positives there. I like some of the youngsters coming in with their exuberance and their excitement, but they've just got to get some of their basics together when you're playing international rugby, especially when you're playing their top two teams. But, hey, finished on a bit of a good note, so let's hope that can resonate into the 2025 season.
Anyway, we move on to MPC, and thank goodness New Zealand Rugby's got something right. They're not changing the competition format. Yippee-yay, thank goodness. They are listening. I have to say it was a fantastic MPC. Life brought back to the Ranfurly Shield with Tasman winning a scintillating match against Hawke's Bay, then losing their last challenge to Taranaki. Wellington and Bay of Plenty proving they were the best sides in a fantastic final. Starting off with you, AJ.
Yeah, you know that I'm an MPC man. I love my provincial rugby. I still think it's something that needs a lot more resources put into. We won't go down the community side of it as well, because that's where it's all coming through. That's the pathway. So big ups for the competition. I hear the stats and the viewership through TV, etc. We're just out of this world. So, look, I think the formula is just about there. I think it needs a bit of tweaking, though. Maybe, you know, I shouldn't say, but possibly just reduce it by one or two in the future, Biggie, just to give it that bit more quality. But, yeah, congrats to Wellington. Steady ship all the way. And then, of course, Bay of Plenty. Isn't it great to see rugby thriving in those provinces? Taranaki with the Shield. Hawke's Bay is always there or thereabouts. Tasman winning the Shield for the first time. Look, it was just one of those seasons, wasn't it, where it just all came together. And I think the future of MPC rugby is strong, regardless of what people are saying. Long may it continue. Go round to your Heartland rugby. Go round to the MPC and see where these crowds are coming along to support their teams. Just a bit of work to go in our big city centres, the Wellingtons, the Aucklands, to try and stimulate the crowds. But really enjoyed the season, and I think that the MPC is here for many years to come.
Stephen.
Yeah, can't disagree with anything you said there, AJ. I know the Rugby Union did a review in late September of the MPC, and I think they were hoping to basically get some results that favoured how they were viewing the NPC moving forward, but the results came back the other way, that it was very much a game that was much loved, but more importantly, it was a pathway to develop players into the next level. It's interesting, this week I did an interview with Mark Robinson, and he was sort of championing the fact that the community game was up by 11%. Well, hello, Mark. you know, that's
I just saw, Stephen, I just saw a pig fly past the studio.
Yeah, just absolutely crazy. And once again, the quality of the rugby was just phenomenal. I went down to the quarterfinal between Bay of Plenty and Hawke's Bay, Battle of the Blades, had a nephew playing for Hawke's Bay, and what a superb game at a nice little sort of boutique little venue. That's the Tauranga Domain of Pacman, like sardines, great atmosphere. I think that's the way to go for a lot of unions. I think it's definitely something Auckland's got to look at. We saw that game that was hosted at Auckland Grammar School. Boy, aesthetically, that looked really good on TV. Absolutely fantastic. We saw Wellington take games to Jerry Collins Stadium. Take your game back to your community. Like, I'm a Westie. I would love to see a game out here at Trust Stadium. Of course, in the past, the Blues have played pre-season games out there, and when it's full, it looks absolutely fantastic. I suppose, and it grates me to mention this, I've got to mention the performance of the Blues partners teams. It was really disappointing. I've got to say, I sort of had high hopes for Northland this year, but unfortunately, they have a new coach, Dale McLeod, coming on board, so he's got a bit of work to do with them. Harder at times looked a $1 million, and then there are other times they looked about $5, especially their performances against both Northland and Southland. I couldn't believe what I was watching. And I just sense with Auckland, probably a bloody-minded idea to play a certain game plan. When you kind of looked at some of the backs they had, or the excitement machines they had on the outside, I couldn't believe they weren't playing a little bit more expansive. But I like the Crusaders in Super Rugby, I don't expect them to be as poor again in 2025. Of course, Auckland will be looking for a new coach. What are you doing, AJ?
No, my days are just sitting here watching it, Steve. I'm not into that coach. It's too dangerous. You're in 1 year, you could be out the next. And I'm too tough on players. I'd be giving them a kick up the arse, and I'm not allowed to do that these days.
Yeah, you're not allowed to do that now. Come on, Steve.
And what did Graham Lay said? There are coaches and there's coaches waiting to be sacked. And he's dead right, isn't he? So, yeah, but just absolutely loved it. And I got to say, guys, the semi-finals were absolutely brilliant, and big ups to Wellington. Wow. They muscled up with Andy. You know, I kind of wanted Bay of Plenty to win. No offense to any listeners from Wellington out there, but you've got to give it to Wellington. And for those two sides, let's not forget, that was the second game that they went into extra time. Round robin, they went into extra time, and Bay of Plenty, again in that final, they went into extra time. And boy, and some players took that advantage to push their claims for, you know, further honours. Duplessis, Karifi being the classic. There were probably about 2 or 3 years ago, I thought he was probably too indisciplined to probably go to another level, but boy, the growth of the men has been incredible. And I'm also going to mention Naitoia Akoi as well. For me, those were the two players of the NPC.
Okay, well, this is the last one, and we've got 4.5 minutes, so I'm going to be quick here. Hey, listen, they're looking eligibility rules. I said this last year that this may become an issue for this season. Yep, I was right. And, of course, when looking at New Zealand Rugby, they're going to bring Richie Mwanga back. It's all but done for $2.3 to $2.5 million. I think this is wrong. I think it sends out all the wrong signals to New Zealand Rugby, where the community game is suffering and provinces are suffering. I'm going to start off with you, AJ Wetton.
Well, I know probably Steve might have a different point of view, but I'm a bit in your camp. I'm a bit old school. Look, I think there's a path already mentioned from your NPC or Heartland and up to Super. If you've got enough, then on to wear the black jersey. We're a small country. That has its disadvantages and advantages at the same time. We have players who want to go overseas for their sabbaticals, fair enough, or they want to go over and play, and for the big money. And it is big money because we can't compete with it, fair enough, and then come back into a side. I think once you leave, that's it. We know the rules. We look at comparison quickly with South Africa. It works for them. I'm saying I don't know it'll work here. You've got to have that pathway. I think you look at Ireland, where we had Gibson Park, Arkey and Lowe could make it. They've gone overseas, playing for other countries and doing exceptionally well. Good on to them. I think that's where it sits. You want to play for New Zealand, stay here. Is it sustainable? Well, I guess we'll find out in the future. But to bring players back, you've got players here who've attained it, have earned the jersey, you've got to give them a chance to mature. I just think it sort of sends the wrong message. But, hey, bigger people will make that decision, but that's where I sit.
Stephen, you're next.
Listen, I think it works for South Africa because they had no choice. To say the value of the rand was virtually next to nothing, so they had no choice but to pick their players from offshore. They're in the same time zone in all of those competitions, so it works for them. For us, I think we have to back our processes, back our HP, back our academies. If you look back at this year, I personally think the first five issue, that for me was a selection issue. They should have plumped on one first five and just backed them. And I think BMAC was just starting to come right, find his feet, get a combination with the best halfback who was Roygaard. I think that's the way you go. If you wanted to open things up a little bit, Super Rugby, I believe players should be able to move around. And if the Queensland Reds want to pay extra top dollar for one of our senior All Blacks, by all means, let him go. All of a sudden, you're talking about a financial burden that's immediately taken away from the New Zealand Rugby Union. But at least you can still select the guy on merit if he's playing good rugby for the Queensland Reds or the Western Force or whoever. And once again, it'll add a little bit more excitement. Man, I'll start watching those teams a heck of a lot more, even when there's the odd New Zealander playing for one of those Australian sides. I do like the fact, though, that they've now only got four teams. But you're dead right. Once you open that door of selecting players from overseas, boy, you really are going to water down your local competitions. Because the players I want to watch are in our local competitions, our NPC, our Super Rugby. I've got to be honest, I don't watch Richie Moana running around in Japanese rugby. I only see the highlight reels when he's running around scoring tries. But for me to sit down and watch a game in its entirety, I never really bother.
Okay, guys, well, I have to say, a fantastic rugby review. AJ, I've really enjoyed our chats every morning at 9. When I call you up at 9:30, there's always a bit of cheek thrown at me, and I've always loved speaking to you. Stephen, I've enjoyed you when you've come in as AJ's replacement. Also for the stuff we've done around club rugby. And, I think it's been I've really enjoyed this year. Hopefully we're back on air next year. And I want to wish both of you a really good Christmas and New Year.
Yeah, well, from my point of view, I think you do a great job, one man sort of band there. And it's just good. As we talk about NPC, Steve, it's like the little fellas all at heart in rugby. I like the little guy punching above his weight. And, boy, you know you're carrying a bit of weight. But anyway, we'll just keep going, Peggy. I think it's great. And I just enjoy the banter. And look, I hope Steve and I, we just add a wee bit of colour, a bit of character to it. We're not the brightest ones out there. We're not the so-called ones on the big sky TV. But our opinions matter. And just want to say good luck and Merry Christmas to you both, and keep up the good work, Peggy.
Yeah, cheers, Stephen. Thank you very much.
No, not a problem. Just want to reiterate pretty much what AJ says, that club component is very important, and I think it's a little bit underestimated by New Zealand rugby. And don't ever be fooled. There are, even with regards to Auckland, there are a lot of people that still support the blue and whites out there. You just got to find your way of getting that community back. And once again, for you, Amon, you do a great job, mate. I'd really love to see the Auckland Rugby Union do a little bit more with this particular show, or something moving forward in terms of marketing.
Yeah, all absolutely. Hey, thanks, guys. Have a great Christmas.
See you, boy.
Cheers. Bye.
Cheers, mate.
Okay. So next up, I've got Professor Mark Orams. I had my mic on, so I didn't say anything rude about Stephen and AJ. But Seamus is heading straight into studio. Seamus Martin for our football. Anyway, it is a Sale GP started last week in Dubai, and of course, a good win for the Black Foils. Here to talk to us, and he was so popular as our America's Cup expert. He is a superb sailing expert. He's Professor Mark Oram from the Auckland University of Technology. Good morning to you, Professor Oram.
Morning, Eamon. From a damp morning up here at Tor Bay at the Superb Lake Regatta. But anyway, we'll get out there eventually.
Yeah, anyway, we might as well head into it. Wow, the first Sale GP of the year, and the Sale GP competition is so interesting. You know, I look at it, it's not just a sailing competition, it has that elements of a bit of transfers, people moving, moving teams, but the Black Foils very had the first win of the season, and of course beating the USA and Great Britain in the final. Really, they've made some changes. Andy Maloney's gone; he's transferred to Brazil. Leo Takahashi's been added to the team. But looking at this event, I thoroughly enjoy the fleet racing aspect of it, but I also enjoy the final of it. It's quick, it's fast, and it's really made for TV.
Yeah, it's a very interesting format that Sir Russell Coutts has developed, and it's really bringing sailing into the modern professional sporting era, and that's his whole vision for it, as he sees Sale GP as a product that sits alongside of other commercial sporting entertainment products in the international marketplace, particularly with a television audience, but also, interestingly, for the first time, with an on-site spectator audience in a grandstand, selling tickets. You know, it's an innovative and perhaps some would say overdue development of the sport. The other part of it, which I think is bringing in non-sailors into it, is that it's incredibly close, tight racing, and some random things seem to happen at times. They compress the sailors into a very, very short racetrack, and that means there's drama, and that makes it really compelling viewing. So overall, I think it's a good product, and the top teams are getting it sorted in terms of their decision-making, but it takes quite a long time for new teams to really get up to speed, and we're seeing that with the two new teams, the Italians and the Brazilians, sort of towards the bottom of the pack at the moment.
And of course, when you look at it adds. It's a different thing. Like we talk about transfers, like it's like a transfer. Like we hear of transfers in rugby and football, etc. But having this in sailing, it really adds to the spice of the competition.
Yeah, it's a whole new element into it, and it's interesting to get your head around it, because I think where this is heading is that eventually the teams will not be sort of nationally branded. They'll actually be professional sporting franchises. And you can already see some movements towards that with the New Zealand team now going by the brand, the Black Foils, that they've developed and trademarked themselves. And while they're all currently crewed by New Zealanders, if you look across the fleet, you'll see an increasing number of crews that are multinational in their makeup. So I think where Russell Coutts has seen this going is a little bit like we see in Formula One or in a number of other sort of racing-oriented technology sports, where you have works teams as opposed to national teams, and they are professional sporting franchises that have owners and sponsors and of course, fans as well.
Well, it may not be the same money as Formula One. The money is good, like $400,000 US for the winner, just in Dubai and the UAE last week. You know, the money is huge. I think it's a $1 million US prize for the finalists. Sailors can actually really make a living out of this.
Yes, they can, and that's providing a pathway not just for sailors. Male sailors who've been able to do that for a number of decades. But I think really importantly, we're starting to see a pathway for female sailors now where they can become professionals and support themselves quite well if they're good. And I'm really pleased to see that. It's long overdue. And I'm really excited to see the first helm in a Sale GP team in Martin Grail from Brazil, helming the Brazilian team. And there's absolutely no reason why a talented female cannot be as successful as a Peter Burling and the like. Martine Grail is a multiple Olympic gold medalist, an enormously talented sailor, and absolutely picked on talent, not on gender, to drive that boat. So I'm really hoping that, that Martine and the Brazilian team, as they get used to the format and the boats, and that takes a while, can really start to push and show what females can do in our sport.
And, you know, that is one of the good things about this event is that you have the mixture of male and female sailors as part of this. And I think it's an inclusive competition, which makes it better. Now, the Auckland event, I am looking at this event. It is all the grandstands are already sold out, the premiums. They're almost sold out on one of the grandstands. 18th to 19th of January, hopefully I can get hold of Carl Budge to have a quick word of the new year about this event. But this is just perfect. It's the perfect time of year. The weather will be great in Auckland, and I think that it'll be a spectacular event.
Oh, and what a great backdrop it'll show too. When we think about broadcasting the best of what New Zealand has to offer in its summer, from a marine perspective, the backdrop right against the central city, the harbour bridge, Rangitoto Island, the inner Waitemata harbour, it's going to be spectacular. And I'm just delighted, given the disappointment of not hosting the America's Cup here, to have something like Sail Chi be in Auckland, it's wonderful for the city. It's wonderful for the New Zealand and especially the Auckland sailing community. Just listening to a presentation from the Black Boils yesterday morning, they're going in with their tails up, having won in Dubai. They're fizzing about the Auckland event. It is the place where, even though they're from other parts of the country, it is the place where they're most familiar with sailing in the sort of adult stages of their careers, and they're really wanting to show what they're made of in that tight course straight off the end of Wynyard Quarter, backdrop of the Sky Tower, the Harbour Bridge. It's going to be amazing.
Absolutely, and you know what, I just think if it's a great weather, I think, you know, Aucklanders, we get, in this part of New Zealand, we get told off for being apathetic, we don't support things, but man, in Auckland we have really missed our international sailing. And this really will bring the crowds out to Wynyard Quarter, the viaduct. People will be watching on big screens across Wynyard Quarter. I'm really looking forward to this event. I think it's going to be great, not only for Auckland, but for New Zealand. And I think, you know, while Sir Russell has had his naysayers over the years here in New Zealand, I think he does what he's doing is a wonderful job bringing it to Auckland.
Yeah, and I think the Sail GP event, and we should give a bit of a nod to Larry Ellison here.
Absolutely,
who's funded this entire initiative. It's a dream that he and Russell Coutts hatched when Oracle lost the America's Cup in Bermuda to Team New Zealand, and they came up with this concept of developing a professional sailing series that could be sustainable longer term. Now, Larry has supported it for the first few years, but now out of the 12 teams, there are 9 of them that are privately owned and self-sustaining. There are only 3 that are still looking for achieving that milestone, which is part of the deal. So part of the deal is you get 3 years as a new team where you receive support. In other words, the boats you've got supplied, some of your expenses are met by the works teams within SailGP. But the expectation is that you're eventually able to bring enough sponsorship on board, ownership of your team, to be self-sustaining. And the fact that they've got that for the majority of the teams now is a really good sign. I'm optimistic about the future of SailGP. The key thing is it's attracting non-sailors who are really seeing it as a compelling watch and something that they are really excited about.
Absolutely. Well, Professor Orams, or Marco, as you know, and to your mates, and I'm getting up to mate status with you. I hope you have a good day. You've obviously got the Blake Regatta today in Torbay.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing. I mean, I was fortunate enough to sail with and learn a lot from Sir Peter and his leadership. And so we've got this regatta here. It's the 22nd year we've been running it. We have 350 young sailors in small boats out, sailing in recognition of the legacy that Sir Peter's created which includes, of course, the America's Cup, the Round the World Yacht Race. We would not have the sport that we have today without the achievements and the leadership of Sir Peter Blake. So I feel heartened when I look out and see all the young people, many of whom weren't born when Peter Blake was alive, who are out there sailing and learning to love the sport in his name.
Professor Orams, thank you very, very much. And I always enjoy your expert comments, and hopefully we can chat in the new year as we look forward to that sail, as we look forward to Sail GP Auckland.
Happy to help, Amon. Thanks.
Mate, always a pleasure. Cheers. Professor Mark Orams, he is fantastic. What a fantastic guy. Well, the big guy's at the door. He didn't have enough time to bring coffee, but he's coming in for football. He's got to come in and keep an eye on me, actually. Anyway, I'll just play a bit of music, and then we'll get to Seamus Martin. Welcome everyone back to the Sports Weekender here on Planet FM, and I have to say, the weather out there is still not the best. And bringing the weather up from Hamilton, please welcome live in studio, the Solomon Island sex symbol himself, Mr. Seamus Martin, who to do our football wrap. Good morning, Seamus.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great. We've got the big guy. Now, I'm actually going to take a photo so that we haven't got AI involved here. But, in fact, I'll do that right now.
Well, look, I feel like I need to start with an apology because I promised you a coffee and I've arrived empty-handed. I forgot how hard it is to get around Auckland.
It's terrible, isn't it? You've got all these bloody, what do you call it, road cones, everything, you know. It's shocking. Anyway, I better set up this camera. God, you know, this is how bad I am with phones. Excitement, and we've got a guy called Ronaldo outside who's looking, nosing in. He's a Liverpool supporter, but he's, you know.
Well, he'd be happy this week, wouldn't he, hey, after the Champions League?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Hey, before we kick it off into the National League finals, big news, and I sent you something this week. Tyler Bindon looks like he could be January heading to Blackburn Rovers.
Yeah, superb, isn't it? It's just desserts for a guy that's really taken his opportunity in the in the English lower leagues, and here's hoping it moves for good things. I think the writing was on the wall when they gave him the captain's armband that this kid's got big things to come. He comes from great parentage in former Football Ferns goalkeeper Jenny Bindon, and his dad Grant played volleyball for New Zealand as well. So look, it's fantastic for Tyler to have the opportunity. Potentially to join a bigger club in January.
Yeah, and a club that's really fighting for a playoff spot in the championships for promotion to the EPL.
Well, that's right, and also a club with a little bit of Kiwi history as well.
Oh, absolutely, the big man Ryan Nelson. Anyway, it's a big weekend of New Zealand football, and it is. We have the National League finals on Sunday, starting off with Auckland in the women's final, Auckland United versus Waterside Karori. You'd have to say Auckland United.
Yeah, look, I go along with that. I think we've been talking for the majority of this year. Just who can stop Auckland United, and I'm not sure anybody will. I don't think Waterside Karori on the day. Maybe, but I think it'll be another trophy for Auckland United into the club rooms there at Keith Hay Park.
Absolutely, and of course then the men's one. Well, these were the two teams that fought out the Northern League final. And Auckland City versus Birkenhead United. Now there'll be most people within the Auckland region will be hoping that Birkenhead United win, but Auckland City really... What they've done is they've started a legacy in National League football in New Zealand.
Yeah, I think you're right. Look, I think it wouldn't just be in Auckland, potentially. I think there'd be a lot of people around New Zealand that we're hoping that the title goes to someone other than Auckland City. But, you know, Eamon, Auckland City just have a knack of pulling out the big moments in the big games. I think they were all but out of the Chatham Cup final. They found a way to take that to penalties. They did lose that match on penalties in the end. But I wonder... Maybe, just maybe, this is Birkenhead's year, but I can't find myself tipping against Auckland City FC. I think they're going to win.
I think you did, right? You know, they have. And as much as I'd love to see the trophy go back to Shepherd's Park and Birkenhead, I just cannot see it, Seamus. I just can't see it at all. In fact, it would be good for the National League if a team like Birkenhead won it. But reality with the Oceania Champions League, many would say World Club Championships, we really do need Auckland to keep winning.
Yeah, that's right. I think it speaks to their consistency that they've had over the years. But look, I think one thing for certain, when Birkenhead find themselves in positions like this in finals, their supporters come out in massive, massive numbers. So I think you can expect the Red and White Army to be supporting Paul Hobson's team over there at North Harbour Stadium tomorrow. But I can't see Auckland City tripping up at the final hurdle.
And of course, we move on to the A-League. Auckland FC versus Newcastle Jets, and I'm going to tell you something right now, mate. My tipping when it comes to A-League football has been fantastic when it's back in Auckland. I forgot to put money on them winning 1-0 at Macarthur, but this could be five in a row. Now, when they brought Steve Corica, they brought a coach with a reputation. What we've seen is this side is playing good football. They're a good team to watch. Many would say it's un-New Zealand-like football, but what we're seeing is good crowds. In the city of Auckland, the city in Auckland have really embraced this team. And, of course, we go next week to the big one in, at Go Media. But you're heading to the game today, are you?
I'm lucky enough to be behind the microphone, so you'll hear my dulcet tones calling the game this afternoon. So it should be an interesting experience.
Who are you working for, Sky?
Yes, yeah, yeah. I'm off the bit. I'm making my debut for the season. So Jason Pine, the great man, has taken the family to the Gold Coast for a family holiday, and I've been given the call up. So a little bit of nerves, and maybe uncharted territory. 5 from 5. You're absolutely right. It's been a fantastic start to the season for Auckland FC, and their success for me has been built on defence. Not conceding a goal yet in those 4 matches. I think Alex Paulson hasn't conceded a goal in nearly 1,000 minutes of football, if you throw in his international appearances as well. He's a man that is playing fantastic, fantastic football, and championships are won on defence. I think they will go 5 from 5 against the Newcastle Jets this afternoon.
Yep, and I look at that defence, you know, Alex Paulson, he is the best goalkeeper in this competition by a country mile. I've got a real suspicion, if it's not in January, at the end of the season, that loan, he goes back overseas.
I did wonder about that point. You know, we talk about Bournemouth picking him up and taking his contract. Let's not forget he is on loan back to Auckland FC. Yeah. So maybe with his performances, we could very well see him back in the UK, which would give an opportunity for a Michael Vowd potentially to step up as well. But look, how good is it that the eyes of the A-League are on here in New Zealand? You've got Auckland FC in top spot, not far behind Wellington Phoenix. I'm not sure if last night's result bumped them from second place, but, you know, the Phoenix have got the weekend off, and you're right. If they win today, Auckland FC, that sets up an absolutely massive derby at Go Media next week against the Knicks.
Absolute sellout. Only tickets available are the $400 tickets, which... Yeah, I might get a bit of hospitality with that, or, you know, I'll speak to Auckland FC and see if they can arrange a prize package, and if a certain Eamon Hallisey wins, well, God, don't know what's going to happen there.
I can assure you, you have a great afternoon if you do like it. I mean, anyone who's going out to the game this afternoon and next weekend as well, make sure you get there. And Bums on Seats is a great currency and a great way to support the game here in New Zealand.
Absolutely. So we move to the EPL, and I'm just going to check. I know that... it's still 1-1 between Southampton and Brighton. A bit of a surprise there, very much a surprise. So we move on to our Sunday matches. And, of course, Seamus is laughing because what I've got here is the old-fashioned notebook. And, yeah, I knew you'd laugh.
Look, I've brought mine in. My only problem is I've got a blank page because I was rushing around this morning, so I've had to go technology.
Mate, my problem is I'm the only one that can read it because my writing's terrible. Anyway, we might as well kick it off. And, of course, looking at it, Crystal Palace versus Newcastle. Well, I'd have to go for Newcastle on this one.
Yeah, look, the tab have got them at 225 favourites. I think I'd back Newcastle, follow you down the line, and back Newcastle against Crystal Palace away there.
Okay, sorry. Nottingham Forest versus Ipswich. I would have to say Notts Forest all the way. Woody to score a goal.
Yeah, I was backing them last week against Arsenal, and they just weren't able to get the lollies on that occasion. I think Nottingham Forest will bounce back against Ipswich Town. They've been struggling. I think I've made a mention of this a number of times on this show. Just the step up from the Championship to the Premier League takes a little bit of an adjustment, so Nottingham Forest for me against Ipswich.
Wolverhampton Wanderers versus big sugar daddy, Big Bill Foley's AFC Bournemouth.
I'm going to sit on the fence. I'm going to pick a draw here.
And this football segment is brought to you by Bunnings for all the best tantalised timbers. You can sit on any fence you want. Hey, you can work for Bunnings because you sit on the fence so much, mate.
Sometimes you can't pick him. Actually, a lot of the time I can't pick him.
Oh, I have to say, sometimes you weren't doing bad until one result the other week. Anyway, Brentford versus Leicester City.
Yeah, Brentford heavy favourites on this one. I mean, I do like the money ball aspect of it. I think I sound like a broken record. I say the same things every week, but there is an element to the way Brentford have assembled their squad. I'd like to see them win that game against Leicester.
And, of course, a bit of a London derby to end the round. West Ham, my old mate Miles Davis, he'll be watching this versus Arsenal. Now, I have to say that Arsenal are just playing fantastic football at the moment.
Yeah, they're pushing Liverpool all the way at the top of the table there, aren't they? I think Arsenal will be far too strong. strong for West Ham in that London derby. And Mikel Arteta, after Manchester City's stumbles in the last few weeks, will be starting to maybe, just maybe, dream of lifting the title for Arsenal.
Absolutely. And, of course, then we move on to Monday. And, of course, we start off with Crystal Palace versus Aston Villa. No, Chelsea versus Aston Villa. And I'm reading off Tribe, not my own handwriting. So I think Chelsea, while they haven't been playing attractive football, I think that they'll get the points here.
Yeah, a little bit of a resurgence, isn't there, at Stamford Bridge? I think Chelsea will be the favourites to get some points off Villa there. But Villa have been a good side in the last couple of seasons. Don't count them out.
Okay, so then, oh God. Manchester United versus Everton. Please, please praise to God that we can actually beat Everton, because Everton are a really... We always stumble against Everton.
Well, you know my feelings on Everton. I can never tip them, so I'm going to have to go with your mob, Manchester United, here, aren't I?
Yeah, well, I thought, yeah, well, I'm going to mention something in passing. Tottenham Hotspur versus Fulham in another London derby. Big Ange is on fire. He'll be a bit disappointed after yesterday's results, but I have to say, saved his job last week, and I think Spurs too good for Fulham.
Well, you texted me on Sunday morning, didn't you, just saying, where did that performance come from, Tottenham? Because they came out of absolutely nowhere to put four on Man City, and I think you're right, it did save his job. It could have even saved his job till the end of the year, that single result.
Oh, yeah, because we were all calling for him to be, that he was likely to be fired. Now, I'm looking at this next one, and it is a match of the round, probably the match of the season, really. Yeah, the match of the season. It's Liverpool versus Manchester City. Now, you remember our big mate Brendan McNeice, he's so famous. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He'd always say, I hope both those sides draw. I hope both those sides lose. I'm actually picking Liverpool, because I'm going to tell you something. I don't think Guardiola's had a worse week in his life.
I think, I don't know what's going on up there at the City Ground, but there is something in the water in that part of Manchester. You're right, I've never seen results like this for Guardiola. I'm not sure he's seen results like this in his career. Liverpool at Anfield start as the favourites. You just can't, I don't think, count out Manchester City. You know, they've got such pedigree, they've got such recent form, but Liverpool the favourites. You know where my heart lies, it's the red side of Liverpool, the Merseysiders. They'll get up for this one. I think they will win this one very, very comfortably.
Yep, I'm actually this could be a weekend where, you know, potentially we're going to see a Manchester City side not in the top four.
Well, it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, they're sitting in second place at the moment, just in the pocket behind. But Chelsea and Arsenal and even Brighton, I think, right up there in fifth spot. And depending on that result against Southampton today, you know, Brighton could find themselves in second place going into the weekend.
Absolutely. Well, Seamus, thank you very much for coming into studio. Next up, I've got Gordon Bray, and we're going to talk a bit about Australian rugby, a bit about his books, The Immortals of Australian Rugby, a bit about Gordon's career. 9 Olympics, 9 Commonwealth Games, and Gordon is in his 70s, Seamus, and guess what he had to call for 9 radio for the Olympics?
Go on.
The breakdancing.
Unbelievable scenes. He'll have some stories about that, won't he?
Oh, yeah. Hell of a good guy. So I will just, I'll just play a bit of music. And next up, we should have Gordon Bray. Thanks, Seamus.
Traveling in a freighter combi on a hippie trailhead full of zombies. I met a strange lady, she made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast. And she said, do you come from a land down under? Where women go and men wonder. Can't you hear the thunder? You better run, you better take cover. He was 6'4" and full of muscle.
she make me sandwich. And he said, I come from a land long ago. He does no one mention her. Can you hear the thunder? You better run, you better take cover.
Welcome everyone back to the Sports Weekend. Well, I'm very privileged to have this next guest. He is an absolute legend in Australian broadcasting. We are talking close to 55 years of broadcasting, starting with the ABC in 1969. He has been the voice of Australian rugby, and I've always enjoyed his commentary because when you listen to a commentator, the match flows, like the commentary flows, and he's unbiased, and he calls it the way he sees it. Please welcome live from Sydney the legend that is Gordon Bray. Good morning, Gordon. How are you?
Good morning, Eamon. Yes, I'm very good, mate. I'm up on the Central Coast, a beautiful part of New South Wales called McMaster's Beach. It's been raining all night. There's a heavy fog in here, and visibility's down to about 100 metres. So it's not what the postcard says.
Okay, Gordon. Looking at the state of Australian rugby, you know, when we look towards the end of the rugby championships, there seem to be a few issues. But looking at this Northern Tour, you've had good wins against England and Wales. You lost to Scotland last week, and Scotland's a hard place to go to. But, you know, a win against Ireland really is a good shot in the arm for Joe Smith and the Wallabies team. Also, he puts one over Andy Farrell going into the Lions series.
Yeah, I think this is probably the most important game of the year for the Australians. You hit right on it. We've got the Lions coming next year. There's going to be a mass influx of supporters from overseas, from all parts of the world, in fact. And Australia, having that hiccup against Scotland last week, they were out of sorts. There's no doubt about that. They lost players just before the game started to injury. Suali'i had an injury early on, and that absolutely fractured the back line. But if you look at Australia's performance this year under Joe Smith, and then go back 12 months to where we were after the World Cup under Eddie Jones, it's a dramatic improvement. Australian rugby was at its lowest ebb after the World Cup, failing to make the finals, record-breaking losses against Wales and then losing to Fiji. It was a horror show. Australian supporters were leaving those games 20 minutes before full-time. So Joe Smith and his squad of coaches have really turned things around, Eamon.
Absolutely, and you have a look at it. For New Zealand rugby, we need a strong Wallabies team, because I look back to that great era of Wallabies rugby, going back to the mid-80s to the early 90s, the late 90s to the late 2000s. This is when New Zealand rugby really found it hard to beat Australia, and Australia was beating the All Blacks consistently. But Joe Smith is a very good coach, and I think, you know, between me and you, and to the hundreds of thousands of people listening, I really feel that he was quite crucial to the All Blacks turnaround for the World Cup in France.
He's an incredible gentleman. He's very popular here in Australia. He's a very modest man. He's a deep thinker on rugby. He's highly experienced. Myself and my son were over in Dublin back 5 or 6 years ago. We were staying at the Shelbourne Hotel. Joe Schmidt was coaching Ireland against the All Blacks. It was the most incredible scene. There were about 2,000 fans inside the hotel for the Irish team coming down from the top floor down the stairway. Little kids with their father and mother, and they were all cheering the Irish team before they'd even left their hotel for the game. And if you could have seen the glazed look on the faces of the Irish players, I thought, oh my God, the All Blacks are in for something pretty amazing here today. And as it turned out, Ireland scored a famous win. So that's Joe Schmidt, and he's back to his old stomping ground. 10 years in Ireland with Leinster and then the Irish team, and I think the Irish players have huge respect for him, so that's why I think this is a very important game. It's one last fling on this Grand Slam tour. They had dreams of the Grand Slam. I was there 40 years ago calling the games, not to be 40 years later, but yeah, this is going to be one hell of a game at the Aviva Stadium this weekend.
Well, you might have to call me the Hex, because when I called you up on last Sunday, I said, there's a huge chance you're going to get the Grand Slam, Gordon. And, of course, unfortunately, I jinxed it for Australian rugby, so I won't be getting many Christmas card from Australian rugby, will I?
Well, I think when we were chatting last week, I really don't think this team is at the level of that 1984 team when you look at the players in that side, the Nick Farr-Joneses, the Liners, David Campese, Roger Gould, Simon Poitevin. You had Steve Cutler and Steve Williams, a front row that was the equal of any in the world. So it was a very special team under Alan Jones. There were only two coaches. It was Alan Jones and also Alec Evans, the forward guru. They had a big scrum machine called Matilda, which they carted all over Britain. And, wow, that pushover try at Cardiff Arms Park, it hadn't happened ever before. And that was probably one of the highlights of the tour. But this team is, in contrast, very different. It's a very young team. They're building, and the potential is certainly there. And I think one of the great things that Joe Schmidt has done this year is he's really increased the depth of the national team. There have been 19 new caps in 2024, and that's very significant. So he's been making 5 or 6 changes for each of these test matches, but he said he, before the tour started, he had an edict that anyone who was selected in the squad, they were going to get a game at some stage. Tane Edmund is going to get a cap, a first cap, and you've seen him in New Zealand this year, and he's done very well.
Very good, yeah.
I thought he'd been left out in the cold, but no, he's coming off the bench, and he's going to be capped for the Wallabies, so that's very special.
That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. And we talk about that 80s scrum, and I always thought about the gentleman who played for Argentina, big Topo Rodriguez, who came over and played for the Wallabies in the 80s.
And we had a massive hooker in Tommy Lawton.
Yeah.
World Rugby hadn't seen a hooker like Tommy Lawton. I think he was 120 kilos. But also, he was an athlete. He had ball skills. He could do a grubber kick. He was a massive human, and he was bigger than the two props either side of him. So you had this amazing front row. It was the biggest forward pack, the biggest tied five Australia had ever fielded. And, yeah, that was a very special team. And that's where Australia has done well, Eamon, when Australia has had a forward pack to compete with any other country. And we saw that in the Rod McQueen era, where you mentioned, it started, I suppose, in the late 70s, that famous win at Eden Park, when Greg Cornelson scored his 4 tries. And then we went through, and finally we developed a forward pack, as you say, under Rod McQueen, where they won the Bledisloe Cup, the Australians, 5 years in a row, which was unheard of. But it was all on the coach strings of a brilliant forward pack and also some very classy backs.
Anyway, you've recently put out a book called The Immortals of Australian Rugby. You've selected 15 of the best players, and not in position, but the best players in your minds that have played for the Wallabies. And looking at that list, it's a marvellous list. You're starting off with, in the 30s, you many would call him probably the father of Australian rugby, Cyril Towers.
Yeah, he was a member of the 27-28 Waratahs. And remember, at that time, there was no rugby in Queensland after World War I. Cyril Towers was from the famous Randwick Club. He coached at Randwick for 50 years. But in his heyday, on that tour of Britain, it was a wonderful tour. They revolutionised the way the game was played. Kicking was at a minimum. They were prepared to counter-attack forward and back from anywhere in the field. And they were really adored by the British public. He figured in series wins over the All Blacks, the clean sweep in 1929, when Australia won all three tests against the All Blacks. And he was omitted sensationally from the tour of South Africa in the early 30s. And then again in 1939, when Australia was to tour Britain, there was a real personality clash with the manager, the coach of the team. He felt that Cyril Towers was too strong a personality. He'd be a destabilising influence. So he was a very colourful character. But as I say, he was regarded as the number one centre in world rugby when he was in his prime. And the interesting thing about him, Eamon, which comes out in the book, in 1936, he went over to Italy on a ship. He wanted to play rugby in South Africa, and he rode his bike to Germany, and he finished up in Hamburg, and he wanted to watch the Berlin Olympics. And he actually found out where the US track and field team was training, and he met up with the great Jesse Owens.
Wow.
And actually trained with Jesse Owens for 2 weeks and could actually beat him out of the start, you know, the first 10 metres before he was hauled in. So that was an incredible experience for Cyril, but it gave you an idea of how explosive his pace was off the mark.
And, of course, then you look at it, you look at some of the next ones. Trevor Allen, captain of the 1949 Wallabies that beat the All Blacks. And there'll still be people in New Zealand rugby saying that, oh, but it was our C team because all our top players were in South Africa. But any time you beat the All Blacks at home, it's great honour. John Fournette, he was fantastic in the Tide series in the 60s against South Africa. His brother Dick ended up playing for Parramatta. And, of course, one of the best halfbacks in the world, and I need to just to confirm this, I think he took over from Des Connor, the great Ken Catchpole.
Yes, well, Ken was very much in the shadow of the great Des Connor, who was... went over to New Zealand as a teacher, I believe, and that gave Ken his opportunity. I, as a young boy, went to the Sydney Cricket Ground in 1959 and watched this young 19-year-old Ken Catchpole make his debut for New South Wales against the British and Irish Lions, and the Waratahs won the game. And I was just spellbound by this young halfback who spent the first year of his life in hospital. He had lung problems, and his parents really got him into a lot of different sports early on so that could improve his lung capacity and his stamina. But he was a freak. Again, he was rated the best scrum half in the world, and his career ended at an international level with that fateful game against the All Blacks in Sydney when, unfortunately, he got pinned in a ruck. One leg was pinned, and Colin Meads pulled the other leg out. He was trying to get him out of the way, and it literally tore him down the middle. But Catchpole bore no grudge against Meads. He said it was an accident. It was a silly thing to do, and these things happen. So he was very adamant about that. There was no blame, that it was a deliberate act of foul play, and that was Ken Catchpole. He was a very modest man. I worked with him on ABC Radio and ABC Television as a commentator, and he was a real lateral thinker. When John Brass, a famous international player, dual international, when he arrived at the Randwick Club, such was Catchpole's level of skill, he said to Brass, who was going to play at number 10, "Do you want the ball?" And they were all leather balls with the you know, the lace on the old leather balls in those days. He said, "Do you want the ball lace up or lace down from the scrum half?" So that was his level of expertise and attention to detail.
Absolutely. And of course, then we go to that era of the late 70s to the 80s, where we saw the emergence of Mark Allah, who made his debut in 1980, Simon Poitiman around that era. And of course, one of the greatest rugby players. He at times could be an enigma, but I remember first seeing him here as a 10-year-old in 1982, David Campese.
Yeah, well, that was he was only 19, as you say, when he came on that tour of New Zealand. And it was because all of the Queenslanders, about 9 or 10 Queenslanders, pulled out of that tour. Whether they were at the end of their career, I'm not sure, or whether it was a protest against the new coach, Bob Dwyer, but it meant that there were a lot of new players in the Wallaby team, and it gave David Campese his chance, and he marked Stu Wilson in his first test, and Stu gave him the highest praise. If I can give you a little quote from the book, and it's my favourite quote in the whole book, Eamon.
Please do.
It's from Professor James Curran, who wrote a lovely tome called Campese, The Last of the Dream Sellers. And this is how he spoke of David Campese, taking him out of his glass cage and exploring his creative genius. And I quote, "Campese seemed to operate on cross-grained pure instinct, one that left many a defender not only clutching in vain at the invisible, but stranded in his audacity's slipstream. He followed no straight path, observed no rule book, conjuring wizardry across the open field. His play was unbridled, unstructured, untamed, unpredictable, and at times uncontrollable. The result was some of the most exhilarating feats ever seen by an Australian sportsman." Wow, I mean, that's some rap, but I guess for people who saw him in the flesh, it really summed up David Campese. And remember, in 1982, he was named by Bob Howitt in the DB Rugby Annual as one of the five players in New Zealand in 1982, and that's for a young kid from Queanbeyan who was playing for Australia for the first time.
Absolutely, and then we move to the era which happened was, and also in the mid-80s we saw Michael Liner, who became a prolific scorer for Australian rugby, and then we also had Nick Farr-Jones, not only a good halfback but a superb captain.
Yeah, wonderful captain. We skipped over another very special player there, Mark Eller.
Oh, absolutely.
He made his debut against the All Blacks in 1980.
Probably the most talented, sorry to interrupt, probably the most talented first 5-8 that's probably come out of Australian rugby. Also a superb man, a man that really got behind indigenous rights in Australia.
Yeah, well, he and his brothers, Glenn and Gary, they toured New Zealand in 1982, and Mark made his debut against the All Blacks in 1980. And if you recall in that series, Australia had a record win in the third and deciding test at the SCG. That was my very first series calling rugby on television for the ABC. And my expert commentator was Trevor Allen, the former Wallaby captain. So we'd gone full circle. In 1949, Trevor Allen beat the All Blacks. That was the year I was born, and then in 1980, here I am alongside him calling Australia beating the All Blacks. But, yeah, Mark Eller was very special, and those three Eller brothers revolutionised the game. They really stood close to the opposition defensive line. They were in their faces. They stood close together. The passing was not long. It was soft passing, but the ball was through past the body in one movement. You really saw very subtle handling skills. They ran straight, and it was all about support play and their running angles. So they were fantastic, the Eller brothers. But Nick Farr-Jones came in 1984 on the Grand Slam Tour, made his debut against the English at Twickenham, and that's where Eller scored the first of his Grand Slam of tries, the first man to do that, a try in every test match in 1984. And Michael Liner came in as the number 12 outside Mark Eller. And he replaced Michael Hawker, who'd been such a star against the All Blacks in 1980. So it really was a grand era. And Eamon, I even convinced my new bride, Catherine, that we should have our honeymoon as well on the Grand Slam Wallaby Tour. So what a way to spend your honeymoon. England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales. And she was my scorer in those test matches.
Are you still married today?
We are still happily married today.
Well done, I have to say. Taking your wife on a rugby tour these days, they would not be interested. You'll be allowed to go, but there'll be a holiday somewhere else along the line. You know that, Gordon. Anyway, then we go back to what really did the late 80s to early to mid-90s, going into that 90s where we had the Bob Dwyer era. We moved on. Australia changed a few coaches from time to time. Then we went to that great era by Rob McQueen. But we were able to, I remember first watching an He was 19 years of age, making his debut. I think he was marking Joe Stanley, Tim Horan, John Eales. What a fantastic athlete he was. A great, not only a great lock, but a great goal kicker as well too. Matt Burke, who I've had the pleasure of interviewing on this show, and an absolute gentleman. George Gregan, an enigma for New Zealand rugby, but really a fantastic halfback. Stephen Larkin, the big, tall, lanky fullback, converted into a first 5'8". And George Smith, when him and McCaw battled in the 80s, geez, that was something to behold.
Yeah, well, you covered all of those people, are all in my 15 immortals. Very quickly, Tim Horan, he made his test debut against the All Blacks at Eden Park in 1989, as you say, as a 19-year-old. I don't think he'd even played for Queensland, marking the great Joe Stanley. Joe, I think, offered his jersey to Horan after the game, and so Tim gratefully accepted it, and then Tim offered his jersey, but Joe said no. This is your first test match. You've got to keep that jersey. John Eales, again, he made his debut against the Welsh in 1991. He was player of the match at Ballymore. Amazing athlete. Probably could have played cricket for Australia. He was a fast bowler and a very good batsman. Matthew Burke, his explosive ability as an all-round athlete, he still holds track and field records in the GPS competition here in New South Wales. George Gregan, yes, as you say, he was a freak. He's one of three halfbacks in my 15 immortals. Stephen Larkin, Bernie Larkin, coach of the ACT Brumbies these days. We had a player in Cyril Towers' era called Tommy Lawton Sr. It was Tommy Lawton's grandfather, and he was known as the Loping Ghost. He was a fly half, a number 10, and he glided around the field. He was tall and lean and very much in the mould of Stephen Larkin. I was at a function in Brisbane yesterday for the Easts Tigers, Eamon, and it was a long lunch. It was a very long lunch. So I have actually lucky to make it home, but I got home last night on the plane. But I was speaking to a very good friend of Todd Aikefu, and he said, who do you think he rates as the best player he played with? Now, Todd Aikefu, as you know, was a great number eight in that era, that Rod McQueen era. And he said the best player I ever played with was Stephen Larkin. I thought he might have said George Smith, but he said no, Stephen Larkin. He said he was an incredible athlete. He had so many injuries, but he just kept coming back off the canvas. He was very lean. He was put together with Band-Aids a lot of the time. But he was a great runner. He could glide through gaps. And, of course, he kicked that amazing drop goal against South Africa in the semi-final of the World Cup in extra time to get Australia through to the World Cup final when they beat France in the final.
Absolute freak of a player. You know, I remember him and starting off the Brumbies in 96, 97, a lanky fullback converted into a first 5'8". He just had all the ball skills in the way. He had all the ball skills that any player you wish you could coach, any type of player like a Stephen Larkin.
Yeah, well, he's, I suppose, with the succession planning for Australia, we're all hoping that Joe Smith's going to stay on after the Lions tour. He said that, you know, with family issues, he wants to spend more time with his family, but Australia desperately needs Joe Smith to hang in there. But if Joe doesn't, I really would love to see Stephen Larkin step up to the mark as a future Australian coach. He's a very modest guy. He's not that fist-banging type like a Michael Checker. But he's very thoughtful. His attention to detail is a bit like Joe Schmidt. And he's just a delightful human being. And then you've got George Smith as well. He was the final immortal of my choice. And Stephen Larkin says of George Smith, he is the best player I've ever played with. I guess the Brumbies are looking after each other there. But Stephen said definitely George Smith could do everything. Whether it be a little grubber kick, his ability to pilfer at the breakdown, and his centre of gravity was quite incredible, like a David Pocock. You just couldn't move him off the ball when he went in to poach. And George Smith, amazing player. He's got a 15-year-old son who everyone's clamouring to get hold of. Apparently he's a real weapon, better than his old man, they say. So look out, New Zealand. We've got another George Smith Junior on the way.
Absolutely fantastic. And when you think about it, that Brumbies side, they've, you know, that's really been the standard bearer of the professional era in Australian rugby. And when you think about it, Gordon, when they first done Super Rugby, Super 12 as it was, you know, the Brumbies were basically a team of the odd ACT player and the rest of rejects from New South Wales and Queensland.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Very much rejects. People like David Giffen came from Queensland. You had Pat Howard. But you had that nucleus, as you say, of Canberra people like Joe Ross, Stephen Larkham, George Gregan. And George Smith came from the Manly Club in Sydney and played all of his rugby with the ACT Brumbies before, at the end of his career, he turned out for New South Wales and also Queensland. But, yeah, a lot of misfits from provinces, and they were moulded into a potent attacking machine, a rugby machine under Rod McQueen and then Eddie Jones. And that was a wonderful era for Super Rugby, wasn't it? When Super Rugby was brand new, there weren't too many teams then. And, yeah, we saw each weekend the Brumbies really setting the standard and, you know, really putting teams like New South Wales and Queensland to the sword, the little brother, really showing how the game could be played. So it really was very exciting rugby, and it was great to be able to call it in those days.
Absolutely. Now, looking back at your career, you started in 1969 with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation back then. You've had the pleasure of you've been to nine Olympics. You've been to many Commonwealth Games. In fact, when we were chatting, your first Commonwealth Games, I believe, was in 1974 in Christchurch.
It was indeed, and I was very lucky to get there. The ABC decided for the first time with their Commonwealth and Olympic Games teams they were going to send a young commentator. And I'd only joined the ABC 5 years earlier, and I was based in Hobart. They'd sent me down there to call Aussie Rules from Sydney. And they were going to send a young commentator, and I thought I was a chance, but there were some very good other broadcasters. There was Drew Morfitt in Perth. There was Peter Mears in Brisbane. And there was another young guy in Hobart called Graham McNaney, who was a mate, and who we worked together. And lo and behold, he got the gig. He was picked for the Commonwealth Games as the ABC's new emerging young commentator. But what happened? He had a farewell barbecue the night before he was departing for Sydney to go over to Christchurch, and he was cooking my steak on his barbecue, and a brick fell off the barbecue onto his foot. And it's been suggested that I dislodged the brick. I did not dislodge the brick, but it landed on his foot, and he was only wearing thongs, and it broke his big toe. We rushed him to casualty, and they said, "Oh God, no! You've got a broken toe. You're going to have this foot up in the air for at least 2 weeks." So suddenly they said, "Well, who's next in line?" And they said, "Well, who's in Gordon Brace in Hobart, mate? You're on the plane next morning." So that's how I got my big break, literally.
And of course,
that's how I got to Christchurch. And I tell you what, Christchurch, It was the first time New Zealand had colour television. Australia did not have colour television at that stage. And the coverage by TVNZ was magnificent. Bill McCarthy was the front man, the compere, and boy, was he in his element. He was I think he started as a sports broadcaster and became a very famous personality in New Zealand, but he was smooth as silk, and the whole coverage by TVNZ, that's where I got to meet the great Keith Quinn and some of the other TVNZ and Radio New Zealand commentators. And it was the start of a grand era and a terrific association with New Zealand broadcasters.
Absolutely. And of course, did you go to the 76 games in Montreal at all?
Yes, I did. I was, in fact, I must tell you there, Graham McNaney, the other young guy from Hobart, who missed out because of that broken toe, he was the first man picked in 1976. Obviously, he was devastated, but they picked two young guys. So I went, and Graham McNaney went. Once, a bit like the old Australian cricket team in the old days, once you got on the ABC Games team, it was almost impossible to get off it. So there were a lot of other young commentators who were pretty disgruntled about it, but we got the gigs. And yes, I know what you're going to ask me. Was I at the hockey final between Australia and New Zealand the men's hockey final where Australia was the raging favourite. Yes, I was. I was scoring for Graham McNaney, the guy who broke his big toe. He called a game for the ABC, and I was his scorer because I'd been covering the yachting in Kingston, Ontario. And that was a shocking games for Australia.
We no gold medals.
Didn't win one gold medal. The big hope was Stephen Holland in the men's 1500, but the two American swimmers set him up. They took him on, and he finished third from memory, or second or third. But the incredible thing was with Stephen Holland, all three, the two Americans and Stephen Holland, all broke the world record. So, you know, you break the world record, and you're regarded as a failure, because he was then interviewed by Ron Casey, the Australian commentator from Channel 9, and he said, do you regard this as a failure? That was the first question he asked him. What a terrible thing to ask someone after they've just broken a world record.
Yeah, but you are talking Ron Casey, and he's never been backwards and coming forwards, has he?
No. There were two Ron Caseys. There was the Ron Casey from Melbourne, who was the boxing commentator. He was on that. It was a combined Australian television team of commentators. And so we had Ron Casey from Sydney, and Ron Casey from Melbourne. And, so that was we all worked together in those days just to, I guess we were trying to save money. But that was the first time we had colour television transmission of sport from overseas. And it's a little known fact, but I actually was the first person to introduce that very first colour transmission from Montreal in 1976 to Australia. So that was quite an historic time, but a real thrill for me to be selected to do that.
You didn't get to call the opening ceremony because, believe me, our old dear friend Keith Quinn, they lost the feed to New Zealand, so the late Philip Leishman had to do this. And, of course, poor old Keith, I think he had the Aussie TV next to him knocking on the door because it was a big boycott. They said, we're going to finish half an hour earlier, we can get to the pub. Keith wasn't happy about that because his feed didn't come through.
Oh, my. Well, that's happened to me. It happened to me in 1981 on the Wallaby Tour, and it was Australia-Ireland at Lansdowne Road. And we called the game in the first half, first time the ABC had ever done a live telecast of a rugby international back to Australia. And the call went pretty smoothly. My expert commentator was Dick Marks, who became the Australian coaching director. And I said we crossed back to Norman May in the studio at half time, gave the score, crossed back to Norman in the Sydney studio, and I turned to Paddy, our technician. I said, Paddy, how do you think it went? He said, Gordon, it was beautiful. It went really, really well. He said there was only one problem. Australia got Fred Cogley's commentary. And I said, what? He's the Irish commentator.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, where did our commentary go? He said, nowhere. But don't worry, we had the wrong plug in the wrong hole, but we fixed it for the second half. So in other words, we commentated the whole first half to ourselves and went absolutely nowhere beyond that little commentary booth. So,
believe me, sometimes when the feed has been lost here, I've had to be speaking to people, figure this is a great show, they're realising it didn't go through. So I definitely understand where you come from, especially when you're doing anything live.
It was such a big moment. I was devastated, but yeah. You've got to recover in those situations. And fortunately, Australia won the game. It was that was the 81-82 team that was supposed to win the Grand Slam. And the Irish game was the only game they won. They lost the next three games. But then all was forgiven 2 years later when they won the Grand Slam in 84.
Of course, looking back at your career as a broadcaster, like, we know you as the voice of rugby, of Australian rugby. You took over from Norman May was the original. You took over from Norman May. And I remember reading Keith Quinn's book, A Lucky Man, who told us some wonderful stories of Norman May, who was a big character.
Well, Norman May was actually a surf lifesaver. He was a state belt champion, and he lost an eye when he was 11 years of age in a bow and arrow accident with his brother in the backyard. So when you consider that he was such a great commentator and he lost the sight, he only had one eye, that was quite an extraordinary achievement. But let me tell you
the first time I met Norman May when I was a young cadet, and I was introduced to him by the Federal Sporting Coordinator, Bert Oliver, and he said, this is Norman May. Norman, I'd like you to meet our new recruit, Gordon Bray. And Norman, he used to have an office on William Street, and he used to just look out the window. The desk was always bare. He'd do the crossword. In those days, you had to go into the office, but Norman was a commentator. All his work was done on the weekends, but they made us all go into the office. So Norman would just sit in his office and look out the window until it was time to go to the pub at lunchtime with Alan McGilvray and race caller Jeff Parney, and off they'd go. But he said, Gordo, when are we going to the pub? And Bert Oliver said, Norman, I don't think that's setting a good example for young Master Bray. That's all right. And Norman said, well, come down to the 729 Club, the television club, on Saturday night. We'll have a few beers. So I went down there. It was at St Leonard's. And Norman had called the rugby match of the day at Chatswood Oval. And then he'd do the television presentation and then go back to the 729 Club at St Leonard's. And I got there, and there he was with his mate Billy McGowan, who was the scorer for the rugby. And they were betting on the greyhounds. They had a little transistor, and that's what they did on a Saturday night. Norman was single. He lived with his mother. He never married. And they were betting on the greyhounds at the 729 Club. And I went up there and said, Mr. May, oh, look, I'm just really looking forward to this opportunity to meet you. And he said, good. Have you got your pay packet? And I said, actually, I do have my pay packet. How much? I said, $29. That's all I was paid. He said, give it to me. We'll put it through the pokies. he said, I'll double it for you. And I said, oh, God, this is my rent and my food for the week. And I gave him a pay packet, and it was gone in 10 minutes. $29 down the bloody poker machines. I've never played a poker machine again in my life. And, yeah, that was Norman May. You know, you'd arrive at the match of the day. There was one day there at Manly Oval. I was going to be scoring for him, and there was no sign of he and Ken Catchpole at 5 minutes to three. And, the telecast starts at 3 o'clock. We're at Manly Oval, and I'm sitting up there, and I've got the headphones on. Never called any sport at that stage. And the producer said, Nugget hasn't turned up. You might have to call this game, Gordon. I said, oh, look, I'd love to. I was ready to go. But at 2 minutes to three, I heard this screech of tyres just outside the wall at Manly Oval, and I looked down, and it was Norman in his little red Ferrari, he called it. It was actually a little red Datsun. And he clambered up the ladder, and with 30 seconds to go, he put on the headset. He said, Norman May here, standing by. And bang, they said, cue Norman, literally straight away. And he said, well, welcome everyone to Manly Oval. It's a beautiful day here, and we've just witnessed an amazing reserve grade fixture. And then he's looking around at the scoreboard to see what the score was, and he said, yes, sir, win to Manly by 13 points to 9. And after the match, I said to Norman when we'd gone off air, I said, Mr. May, how could you say that? You weren't even at the game. He said, yes, I was. We were watching over the road from the RSL club. We were just running a little bit late.
That was very much similar to, I think Keith Quinn was sent over at his first overseas commentary in rugby, working for the ABC. And, of course, he had Norman May and Trevor Allen. And I think the big thing was, what was it? I think during the match, Norman went missing, and he had to do the match with Trevor Allen. Then they went across to the pub to find him, and he said, God, for God's sake, you guys are late. These beers get warm.
Oh, no, he was a demon. And he and Alan McGilvray, the great cricket commentator, they would, before test matches, when I was doing test cricket, when the ABC covered test cricket, I was doing rugby in summer, in winter, and cricket in summer. So we'd travel around Australia. And before each day's play in a test match, we'd have a prayer meeting in Alan McGilvray's room, as he called it, at about 8 o'clock in the morning before the test match. And they would drink 7-ounce glasses of beer at 8 o'clock in the morning with Norman O'Neill and Norman May and Alan Marks and the other commentators. I must admit, I was not prepared to drink
beer at that hour of the morning, but that was just normal. They'd discuss how they were going to handle a day's play, and that was called the prayer meeting in Alan McGilvray's room, and it happened religiously every day from 8 o'clock on each day of the test match. So it was a different world. But I must say, all of our education, most of our education was done in the pub, listening to the likes of McGilvray and Norman May and all of these wonderful, legendary, iconic commentators. So as a young person, you'd just be all ears. And it was just a magnificent education.
It's amazing because you hear so many funny stories like that. Looking back in your career, and we know you as the voice of Australian rugby, but you've covered Olympics, you've covered cricket, you've seen broadcasting change in Australia from where the ABC to the PAC era taking over World Series cricket to where we have Foxtel and all the pay-per-view channels and cable channels that are coming. But looking at your sporting moments, to you, what was one of your, looking back, what was one of your greatest sporting moments outside of rugby that you had the privilege of commentating, being a commentator for?
Well, probably one of the most incredible sporting moments inside rugby was calling at Brighton, the Brighton Miracle in 2015 Rugby World Cup, when Japan beat South Africa. That was probably the most extraordinary match I've ever called. But I did have an inkling that Japan was going to do it. I got to Eddie Jones the day before, and he told me how they were going to do it. And lo and behold, South Africa were rolled by a Japanese team with that try by Kaan Heskett in the dying stages. The Kiwi on the wing, who came on as a replacement. That was the most incredible thing. But if I look back on my career, the Hockey Roos, I called them winning the gold medal in 2000. Calling sailing gold medals at the London Olympics, and that was a thrill. Australia won three gold medals. The Aussies and the Kiwis always are world renowned as yachties, as sailors. So that was very special. But just representing your country at international events, having the best seat in the house, I think that makes it all very special. Whether you're covering weightlifting or sailing or marathon running, it's all out there. I think the men's K4 at the London Olympics came out of the blue. They came through and won the gold medal. So it's about, I guess, being flexible. If someone says, do you want to call this sport, don't shy away from it. Say, absolutely. So when I was calling for Nine Radio at the Paris Olympics,
oh, yes,
that we were calling out of the Sydney studios of 2GB, they said, who wants to put their hand up for the breakdancing? And I thought, oh, my God, breakdancing. What do I know about breakdancing? Yes, absolutely, zilch. But I put my hand up, and, yeah, I got the call of breakdancing. But I did adopt, I must say, we adopted the Roy and HG approach, a bit like the when they were Roy and HG. Roy, you know Roy and HG in New Zealand, do you?
Yeah, yeah.
Calling the gymnastics and hello boys and the battered Sav and all that sort of stuff. So we did adopt that approach with the breakdancing. And, it was very amusing. But every challenge is there, and you take it as it comes, and you can only do your best.
Gordon, I have to say I've really enjoyed this interview today, and I have to say always enjoyed your commentaries from afar, and I know you've got a good relationship with New Zealand sports fans. I hope that you have a great Christmas and New Year, and Gordon, I hope this is not our last conversation on air.
I haven't, it certainly won't be, and can I put a shout out to my dear friend Murray Deeker?
Yep.
Who I guess, the Australian correspondent on his show for two decades. And whenever I'd come to New Zealand, I'd either stay with Murray after the Bledisloe Cup game, and then we'd go up to Gulf Harbour and we'd play, or we'd play at one of his other favourite links courses. And, Murray, a very dear friend, and I think he's playing...